Coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Well, hello everybody, and happy Tuesday night to you all. I hope everyone is getting ready for the holiday season. Hope everybody had a happy Krampusnacht this last week. There's an awesome first annual Krampus festival and parade in, or no, I don't know about festival, but at least parade in San Antonio. And I did not get to make it to that. I saw some of my friends did, so I'm glad that they did. Glad that y'all had fun. Glad that that is going on. Cool to bring some of these original traditions back to the world. We're going to be having a great night tonight of guests. In our second part, we will be talking about traditions. Before we even get to that, we've got like weeks of pre-record stuff coming up, folks. It is, of course, coming up on holiday season, all that kind of good stuff. So next week we'll be live. We'll have James Subski coming on to talk about cryptids of the Northeast, all that kind of good stuff. We'll be talking with Anthony Esemplare from Epic TV up in the New Jersey, New York area, videotaping all kinds of UFOs, drones, things like that, that are happening in the skies right now up there. And then we begin our pre-record stuff for the holiday season and for a couple of weeks of work that I'm out on in the beginning of January. And for that, for your Christmas Eve pleasure, we'll be having Margie Kay and Violet Wisdom on to talk about their new book, How to Research a Haunted House. So if you're looking to buy a home, if you're looking to rent a home, things like that, how do you actively find out? Because not every state is a full disclosure state. So how do you find out if there's been a murder in the house? How do you find out if there's, you know, possibly a haunting, things like that? So we'll be getting into that with them. Then we have John Eric Ege, the new Texas state director for MUFON, on talking about Texas MUFON stuff and Texas UFO cases. On the 31st for New Year's Eve, we will be talking with Nathaniel Gillis, our good friend and demonologist, about dark entities that have been skulking around since the beginning of man, living in our skins and using us to procreate and to move forward. Wild stuff with demon body snatchers with Nathaniel Gillis. Then we'll have Dr. John Hall on talking about targeted individuals. The week after, we'll have Dennis Stone talking about America's Stonehenge, and we will also have Chester Moore talking about Happy Face killers, the serial killers and serial killings that may possibly be tied to the Rainy Street murders right here in my backyard in Austin. And we're looking for the second guest, but right now the first guest for the 14th of January is David Oates, and we'll be talking about reverse speech and what that is all about. Our second guest tonight, speaking of ancient civilizations, we'll be talking with Jason Quitt about his work with Gates of the Anunnaki and ancient alignments inside of artifacts, carvings, hieroglyphs, things like that, that really show a very, very advanced knowledge of the sun, the moon, the cycles, what they meant to them, both religiously and societally, because they lived and died by it, folks. So our guest in the first segment tonight is the amazing Rob Ryan Sullivan. He is the host of A Trek Within. I have been on the show a couple times. It is a fantastic show. It explores all kinds of topics. We've talked about brainwave frequencies. We've talked about the paranormal on there, all kinds of stuff. His book is A Trek Within. Welcome to the show tonight, Rob Ryan Sullivan. How are you doing today?
I am doing great. Thank you very much. Always fun to talk to you.
Man, it is always great talking with you. I've been, like I said, been on your show a couple times, and it's a fantastic platform that I think is really a great way for average people to kind of expand their mindset. You know, that beautiful quote from my man Frank Zappa, Your mind's a parachute. It's best if it's open, you know? How did you first come down the path of really trekking within, the idea of exploring yourself, exploring deeper things in the world around you, Rob?
Well, you know, it's nothing that I ever expected to be doing. Let's put it that way, because, you know, I grew up very traditional upbringing, you know, raised in a Catholic family of five brothers and sisters. You know, I was not raised to believe in reincarnation. I was not raised to believe in synchronicities or, you know, the value of dreams or anything like that. It's not like my parents were against it or anything like that. They definitely weren't. Sure. But it just wasn't something that we talked about or something that really showed up. But throughout my life, you know, it was interesting, you know, more or less as I was looking back, I realized there were all of these signposts along the way of different things that were, it was like life was preparing me in many respects for things that I was to encounter later. Mm. And I thought, okay, this is more than a coincidence, you know, and I love, like, you know, I think it's Carl Jung who's, you know, described synchronicities as meaningful coincidences. And then I think it was Albert Einstein who said, it's God's way of remaining anonymous. And I love those ideas because I don't believe in coincidence in terms of, oh, that was just chance. There's too many things that have happened in my life that really have shown me that there's a lot more going on than we have maybe traditionally been led to believe or raised to believe in certain cases.
Absolutely. You know, and I mean, of course, my audience would be familiar with probably one of the best examples of that from The Matrix, the deja vu scene of, you know, like, oh, deja vu. I just saw a black cat. I thought I saw it a while ago. And it's like, oh, that means there's a glitch, you know? And that is definitely a concept out there. The idea that that is a moment, a unique moment when one of those happens where, things just kind of coalesce together. Like you said, it's odd. And when you start really opening your mind and becoming connected in different ways to the world around you, Rob, you really do find, a lot of connection in that kind of way.
Yeah, absolutely. And it doesn't all have to be save the world kind of thing. You know, like today is a wonderful example. Before I got back to the apartment, I was over at Whole Foods and I walk in there and I see a woman I know from high school. And I said, Megan, you know, how are you? And we talked for a little bit. And she brought up one of her friends, a woman named Bean. Well, we had two Beans in our high school class. And she was talking about, you know, I was friends with Bean Heilitzer, and she was talking about a woman named Bean Patterson. And it was interesting because as we were having this conversation, I started thinking about the other Bean. And then literally, as I'm walking out of Whole Foods, I did a double take when I thought I saw the other Bean. Now, the other Bean doesn't live in Chicago anymore, as far as I know. But it was, I mean, this woman looked like she could almost have been her twin sister. And it was, you know, is that super meaningful? No. But the way that I look at that is, it's like the universe's little way of telling you you're exactly where you need to be. You're in the right place at the right time. Yeah. My friend Megan calls them God winks. And I love that because it's just a really nice little, hey, you know, whatever else is going on for you today, don't worry about it because you're where you need to be.
And you know, it's interesting because you'll get those moments in life. The way that I used to explain it to junior high and high school kids that I taught spirituality and religion to was to feel for the kite string behind your belly button. You know, like you'll walk into a room one day and you will feel a genuine tug at the back of your belly button. Whether that means good, bad, whatever, it means pay attention. Mm-hmm. Like and whatever gut feeling you get, follow it. Like if that gut feeling is like, I don't need to be in this room, get out. Like, run. If your friends don't want to go, sorry, friends, see ya. You know, like, follow that. It will never steer you wrong. And it's pretty interesting and fascinating. I just personally had a huge synchronicity one. And synchronicity is a big thing in the remote viewing community. The idea that, you know, we are connected to not just numerous points in space, but numerous points in time simultaneously, Rob. And a lot of it comes in the term analytic overlay. The idea that you're putting another situation on top of what you're viewing. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you're wrong with what you're doing. It's just that that has now influenced the session, and it may be something that happens a week from now that isn't even your target, you know? And like I had one, on the remote viewing cruise, we had a fun task of finding an object to go to the casino and gamble in. I saw a blue horseshoe, went to look for it, never found it. And I was like, well, you know, I am going to Vegas for a client next week. Maybe I'm supposed to go to Binion's, maybe just something like that, you know? So I tell my buddy who I'm on a show with, hey man, I'm supposed to be looking for a blue horseshoe this week. Help me keep an eye out while we're out bar hopping, having drinks, whatnot. Well, he's like, we have a big client on this show, and if we do well, we'll get the client. So I tell him about the blue horseshoe, all that kind of stuff, and the week goes on. The last night comes. He asked me if I want to go out for drinks after dinner. I'm like, man, I got an early flight. I went to bed. About 1 o'clock, he texts me. By the way, we got the gig. The client has a tattoo of a blue horseshoe on her left ankle.
Amazing.
and one of those, like, wow. Okay. Did I remote view that, or is that just an amazing point of synchronicity? Because that's a pretty beyond coincidence situation, you know? But
way beyond coincidence.
But why?
And I love that. You know, and the way you described it, you know, that tug, it's so funny because I hadn't thought about that feeling that way. But I remember early in my career, I don't even know how I happened to be there because I didn't commute, you know, via the train station downtown in Chicago, but I happened to be in the Union Station, or actually it was Ogilvy, but there was an art show. And so I was walking around looking at these different artists, and there's this one artist and I really liked his work. And at the time, what he was charging was way more than I could afford. And I was like, okay, you know, I made a mental note. I wrote down his name. I got a card. Actually, he was doing these like thank you cards. So I bought like a pack of 10 or 20 thank you cards. So I had his artwork and I had his name with that. And then a couple of months, weeks go by, I don't remember exactly how long, but I was walking home down Lincoln Avenue, the street that I lived on. And I'll never forget, I was walking, I lived on the west side of Lincoln Avenue. I was on the west side of Lincoln Avenue. I was about a block from my house. And all of a sudden, I noticed that I was being drawn to the other side of the street. I was literally crossing the street without even realizing that I was crossing it, when it wasn't, that's not the way to go home, right? And so I'm thinking, okay, well, obviously there's a reason I'm doing this. And I look in front of me and there's this secondhand store. I thought, okay, well, maybe, you know, this book that I've been looking for is in the secondhand store. So I walk in and I walk over toward the books, and there was, you know, I scoured around, couldn't find it. And I got this idea. I said, oh, you know what, I'm going to go stand. Fortunately, there wasn't anybody around. And I stood in the middle of this room because I felt drawn to the room on the right. There was a big room on the left, actually twice the size, but I knew that wasn't the one I was supposed to be in. So I stood there in the room and I just kind of like, just shut my eyes and I was like, guide me, what am I doing here and where am I supposed to go? And I immediately knew that I was supposed to turn around and work my way toward the window. Now that involved literally climbing over furniture and all kinds of stuff they had stacked. So I'm doing that, I'm climbing over, and I get to the window and there's all these paintings up against the wall, and I start going through it, and there's a painting of this guy's on sale for $25, an original.
Wow.
And I was, that's so cool. So I like bought it, and I was like, oh, this is amazing. And I knew, but then you get that release, because that was the moment that I knew this is why I was here. Now the painting, now you might say, oh, well, maybe you saw the painting out of the corner of your eye. I didn't. The painting was, it was smaller than the other ones in the stack. And it was in the middle of it. There was no, I didn't see the image. There was no way I could have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because once you, we are all tuned antennas, every one of us. The problem is that we have been programmed to detune ourselves, from the time that we're children, you know. Unfortunately, there are many, many more enlightened parents out there now. There are many more enlightened grandparents out there now who understand and even get the fact of, you know, maybe the kid isn't talking to an invisible friend. You know, maybe, or it is an invisible friend, or maybe they don't have an imaginary friend, you know. So it's fascinating to think about that. It's interesting to see the work of people like Caroline Corey, who are out there, you know, and even our guest recently, Hakeem, with the Psy Games coming up, who works with children, teaching them to see the world blindfold, teaching them to like lightsaber fight blindfolded, that kind of stuff. It's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, it really is. And like you said, there's so much truth there that we don't really even know. One of my favorite stories in the book was it all happened because my friend Marge was staying with me in Chicago a number of years ago. And another friend, Wilbert, who's a writer, came over. He was asking me about the book and what was going on. And I told him about some of the stories. And she looked at me and she said, "I've got a story for you." And she gave me permission to you know, use her story in the book. And what had happened was when she was a little girl, she remembered doing when she was in kindergarten, they did this little, I can't think of the right word. It's not a mural, but
like a collage.
Yeah, kind of that kind of thing. And then, but everybody in the class had to do a self-portrait, and then they wove them together in one of those like blanket kind of things.
Okay.
And so she, you know, her mom found the blanket like years later, because at this point, Marge is in her 20s. And Marge is looking all over for this little girl, Matilde's picture. And her mother's like, "Marge, there was no Matilde in the class." She said, "Oh, yeah, there was." She said, "I remember her." And Matilde was somebody who had shown up in her dreams, and she was like her best friend. And she knew that, you know, Matilde was in the class. Well, then she goes and finds the class picture. And she points to this little girl and she goes, "This is Matilde." She said, "I told you there was a Matilde in the class." And her mother looked at her and laughed. And she goes, "Matilde," she goes, "that's not Matilde, Marjorie, that's you." And then Marjorie figured out what had happened. Her mother, and she didn't know this until she was like 18, I think. Her mother, when she was pregnant with Marge, fell down. And you know, one of the twins died. She was pregnant with twins, and one of them died. And the original plan was to name them Stephanie and Matilde. But then when there was only one, they changed that plan completely, and they named the remaining twin Marjorie. And so it was only in that moment that Marjorie realized that Matilde, this girl who looked a lot like her, that was always around and often in her dreams, was really her twin.
Interesting. That is wild. And
yeah.
And once again, the idea of synchronicities, the idea of seeing things either before they happen, seeing things repeat in the world, realizing the fact that you were at a location for a very specific reason, that did not pre-exist. You know, it's not like you had that on your checklist of things to do today. You know?
Yeah.
And it's pretty fascinating when you start getting into that. Now, when you began to write this book, what was the first thing that came to your mind as far as how to weave these stories together to bring people to an understanding of how synchronicities work, Ryan?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because what ended up happening was, the original thing, you know, there were all these different stories that I was writing down that I felt like I didn't know what the connection was at the beginning. And then I ultimately realized that the connection between a lot of these stories is that they were all, what they had in common is that they were not things I was raised to believe, but that I've come to embrace. Okay. And that was, and so like working from that, but you know, it still wasn't done. And that was the weird thing about the book, because I always had this feeling, you know, with my first book, I wrote it relatively quickly and it came out within 2 years or something like that. This one was like more than 10 in the making. And interestingly, two of my favorite of the most powerful like stories and events didn't even happen until like literally right before the book came out in many respects. And so, well, not one of them was a few years back, but the other one, and this is one that you'll really appreciate, because, you know, you were talking about signs, And sometimes, you know, they're just like the really fun ones, like, oh, cool, I found a painting by an artist I was really interested in. Great. Not life-changing, but fun. And one of those things that just adds a little depth of richness to your life. But I literally had my life saved by a dream. And it was, that was the one that really got my attention. And I'll share what happened with
that. Please,
please. In this dream, I'm standing on the shore of an ocean looking out, and it's the water's really rough. So you could tell that there had been a storm, and the sky was still pretty dark, but it wasn't, you know, currently, you know, there was not a storm there right at that moment. Well, this lifeguard is standing next to me, and he communicates telepathically, which has only happened in like two or three dreams I've ever had. He communicates telepathically that he said, don't be thrown off by the relative calm. He said, it's going to get worse before it gets better. And he turns around and he runs at top speed. And I'm thinking to myself, if the lifeguard's running away from the ocean, I better be doing the same thing. So I turn around, I start running. And by the time I catch up to him, and this is all happening, and I'm going to call it a vision, because in my estimation, you know, dreams are the ones where they don't stay with you as long as a vision would. Like, I remember this one, like every detail that could happen yesterday, where, you know, I had dreams on the train on the way down here just now that, you know, when I fell asleep that I don't remember now. So that would be the distinction. So when I get caught up to him, there's a wall to my left, and this wall is like 50 feet high, and it's huge cinder blocks, like stacked up on top of each other. And they're about that wide and probably about that long. And as I get there, this wave crashes into the wall. And you can see the water coming through on the other side. And there's like seaweed, you know, pouring down. And it's just, that was like what happened as I got to the wall. And I looked up and there was water in the distance too. So I was obviously on some sort of a peninsula. Well, I woke up and I was like, wow, that was just incredible. Fast forward, go to the gym that morning, and I pull the muscle. And so my collarbone was kind of bugging me, and I was massaging it a bit, not really thinking too much about it. It didn't hurt. It was just, I was aware of it. I go to the doctor for a cortisone injection in my ankle. And I happened to ask him, I said, you know, one thing I'm a little bit curious about is, I said, if my ankle is bone on bone, there's no cartilage left, why is the pain up my leg a bit? You know, it's like 3 inches up my leg. It's not in my ankle. And he said, it's referred pain. He said, you know, like if you're having a heart attack or something. So that's interesting. My next appointment is the endodontist. My dentist sent me there because he was worried there was a tooth that was cracked and he couldn't see it on the x-ray. So he sent me for a 360 x-ray, and the endodontist looks at me and he goes, that tooth up on top, he said, is that sensitive to hot and cold? And I said, that one is not, the one immediately below it is. And he said, oh, that's referred pain. I'm thinking, why am I hearing about referred pain twice? And for people who don't know what referred pain is, a great example of that is when I went through chemo a number of years ago, I was getting a shot and they gave me the shot in my left elbow. But the pain that I felt when they hit the nerve was in my hand.
Yeah.
Nowhere near the needle. But, you know, so that's referred pain when it's somewhere else. And so I'm thinking, why am I hearing about referred pain again? Well, I go about my day, have a coaching client in the afternoon. And as I'm finishing that up, I'm really hungry, craving shrimp tacos. So I start walking up Grand Avenue in Chicago on my way over to this place called Gringo's that had really good tacos at the time. And I get to the corner of Grand and Ogden, and this collarbone thing came back. Now, this was a big nothing burger. It didn't hurt. It was just kind of a weird little cramp. But it caught my attention because as soon as I came back, I remembered the dream and I remembered how the lifeguard said, don't be thrown off by the calm. The storm went away, but it's coming back.
Yeah.
And so when it came back, I literally, it sounds dramatic, but I stopped. Now, there were people around, so I didn't say it out loud, but quietly I said, do I need to go get this checked or can I go get shrimp tacos? That was my exact question to the universe. And the answer came back immediately. You need to go get that checked. Yeah. So I jump over, go over to the emergent care, whatever they call it. And I don't even remember what I told them when I walked in, but it was obviously, it got their attention because they hooked me up immediately. And the woman looks at me and she goes, you need to get to the hospital right now. She said, you are having a heart attack. And now I work out 6 days a week. I'm not your average, you know, I'm not somebody you look at and think, oh, he's a, you know, candidate for that. But what was interesting was when I got to the hospital and they put the stent in and figured out what was going on, the artery on the left wall of my heart was 90% blocked. Well, think about the vision. It was the wall on my left that was blocking 90% of the water when the wave hit it.
Oh, wow.
I'm as dense as could be when it comes to like English classes and figurative stuff in books. I miss all of it. That I recognized immediately. I was like, wow, that's powerful. And it was interesting because I went to a college reunion this summer and one of my roommates from college is an emergency room physician. And I told him this story and he looked at me and he's like, Rob, he goes, you're the luckiest guy I know. He said that what you had is the Widowmaker. He said, if you had ignored that, you wouldn't be here right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, that's just it. Learning to understand those small little signals. We've got a different way of understanding that. We have a different way of being connected to that. And there's so much that is coming out, as we've talked about on your show before. There is so much that is coming out in science that is proving what ancient cultures have taught, that is proving what meditation has taught, that is proving what even remote viewing has talked about, the idea that we are all connected, that there is this greater, larger connection somehow, whether it be dimensionally, what have you. And I've even posited the fact of specifically with dreams, because before I ever did remote viewing, before I ever tried to do astral travel, which I was never really personally successful at, I did a lot of dream work, Rob, where I traveled the same path every night to go to my meditation place and talk to my guide and look for answers to problems that I was having within my dreams, you know? And it's a pretty cool meditative practice and it can really get you to sleep in a different way. But it's fascinating to see the fact that, yes, you can find these things in your dreams. You can tune in that kind of way and really get insights to your life and the world around you and that kind of stuff in real time.
Absolutely. And I really do believe that sometimes all you have to do is ask. You know, it's amazing to me how, you know, quickly prayers can be answered. And, you know, I know a lot of people don't necessarily believe in that, and I'm not trying to convince anybody of anything. No. I'm not trying to start a new religion. But I do know that, you know, like, for example, when I experienced lymphoma a number of years ago and went through chemo and all that kind of, you know, 5 days in the hospital every 6 weeks or 3 weeks or whatever it was.
Yep.
And I remember, you know, I was very public about what I was going through because I did not want people to visualize me checking out early. I'm a big believer in energy and I didn't want people feeling sorry for me or anything. I just wanted to control that to the degree that I could. And it was interesting because it asked people to visualize the tumors shrinking. And my friend Cynthia, I'll never forget, she texted to say that she had a vision or whatever. I don't know if she was meditating or whatever, but her vision of as she pictured the tumors, she saw them melting, which is an interesting word.
Yeah.
Because I found out later that one of the drugs called Rituxan, its function, it's the first drug they give you, and its function is to melt the shell of the tumor.
Yeah.
And then melt is the word that the oncologist used. I'd never, and he didn't use it. I've heard it for the first time after Cynthia told me about her vision.
Wow.
And I'm sure I didn't know that. I certainly didn't transfer that to her. And I doubt she, you know, when she told me about it, it sounded like she was kind of surprised too. So it was pretty wild that she was visualizing what they said was basically happening.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And, you know, it's interesting when you start getting into things. We actually had a listener who chimed in, Victoria. I feel bad for those who refuse to acknowledge synchronicities when they happen in life. They're missing out on a universal euphoria. And I would tend to agree with that. There is a beautiful bliss that happens when that little bell is rung of connection in a deeper way and a more rooted way to the world around you, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, going back to the dreams and signs, you know, that, you know, it's when you miss it that you really do sometimes think, oh, you know, it's unfortunate. Like when I was working on the book, I have kept a dream journal for a long time. And so I was going back into one of my dream journals, trying to find a particular dream. And I didn't find that, but I found this other dream. And in the dream, I had written down that a guy named Asa Baber. Now, Asa was a columnist for Playboy magazine, and he had reached out to me at one point. He had seen me interviewed on TV, and he and I became friends. And but, you know, not like friends, but like we went out to lunch and he would kind of mentor me on some writing related things. But we had lost touch. And in this dream that I'd written down, he was in the hospital. Now, I didn't, you know, make it. Now, what I should have done in that moment is awaken and said, oh, Asa, you know, while he's in the hospital, I should just call him and check in and see how he's doing.
Yeah,
I didn't do that. Now, when I looked at the date of the dream, what I had found out in the interim was that, because this was, the dream had been a couple of years before, and he had died shortly after that of Lou Gehrig's disease. So when you look at the,
oh, wow,
the date of the dream, he was almost certainly, if he wasn't in hospice, he was definitely in the hospital at that point.
Wow.
You know, and I only wish that I paid attention to that to be able to call him up and, you know, just say thanks or goodbye or whatever. And I didn't pay attention to it. Now, I'm not beating myself up for that. I think, you know, I had a professor or a priest actually in college who used to say, God draws straight with crooked lines. And I love that expression, yeah, because it's not an excuse for bad behavior, but it's a nice way of forgiving yourself for the, you know, idea that sometimes you have to do what you have to experience what it's like to be or do what you don't want in order to truly appreciate and get on the right path.
Yes. Yes. And that I think is something that sadly a lot of people A, don't have the patience for, B, lose sight of. Rob is, and even the idea of, you know, let's bring it around to prayer and synchronicity, and the idea of your prayer may have well been answered. It was just likely not answered within the very defined box that you had in your head. You know, your prayer may have been answered by the fact that you didn't get what you prayed for, you know. That may quite literally be the gift from the universe, is that no, you really don't need what you were trying to get. And trying to recognize that and trying to see that and trying to understand that sometimes it's the subtleties. It's that calm, gentle breeze, not the gusting wind that we're supposed to be looking for. You know, it's that, once again, that small little tug, not somebody shoving you off a ledge.
Well, sometimes, though, you know, I have this vision of my guardian angel just having his head or her head in their hands like a large percentage of the time, just because I can be a little on the dense side. And it's funny. I got to say, occasionally I've had it happen where my prayer was answered instantly in a way that even I couldn't miss it. And so I'll give you an example of that if you want, because one of the stories in the book, too. So there was a guy that I had become friends with, and he was a musician, really talented guy. And it was through the course of our friendship, like he taught me to play a bunch of songs. And he's like, dude, I want you to play on my next album, which was a huge compliment because I basically suck as a guitarist. And I'm not just, you know, that's not me being self-effacing. I'm, you know, I can play a couple of songs. It's not, you know, a great thing. But anyway, so he and I had become friends. And then all of a sudden, you know, the last time I saw him, he had asked me about a particular woman that I had dated. And he said, you know, are you, you know, dating so-and-so? And I said, no. And in fact, I knew that he was really interested in her. I said, you know what, you should call her. I said, because I know she'd go out with you. And so next thing, I hadn't heard from him in a while, but the next thing I did hear was that those two were dating. And I thought, okay, great. You know, no big deal. Well, he had a big birthday coming up, but I didn't remember. I knew it was in April, but I didn't remember the exact date. So I called her up and I said, you know, hey, I haven't heard from him in a while. And I know he's got a birthday coming up, but I don't want to forget it. I don't want to miss it. You know, so I wanted to, you know, check in with you and find out when it is. And she said, she paused and she sounded pretty annoyed. And she goes, you're not going to hear from him either. I'm like, what do you mean? And she goes, you lied to him. I said, what are you talking about? And she said, I said, about what? And she said, about us. I said, I'm totally confused. What are you, you know, tell me more. She said, well, she said, he asked you if we had ever dated and you told him no. And she sounded, you know, justifiably annoyed if I would, you know, have been denying the fact that she and I had dated, which we had. And I said, that wasn't the question that I understood. I thought he was asking, are we currently dating? And I said, and by the way, what difference does it make? I said, because my understanding is you guys are dating, and I had encouraged him to call you. So I failed to see what harm this has caused. And she said, I said, I'll certainly apologize to him because, you know, it's, I didn't intentionally mislead him. But, you know, what difference does it make? And she's like, well, he has a policy that he won't date anybody that any of his friends have ever dated. And I'm thinking to myself, what are we, 11? But, you know, I put that little judgment aside and I pick up the phone. Now, I know in my heart it takes two to miscommunicate, but sometimes the better and easier thing to do is to own it. And so I figured I'm going to just own 100% of this. I'm not going to put any of it on him. And I called him up and I knew I wasn't going to hear from him, but I left him a message and I said, hey, I'm really sorry. I did not, you know, mean to mislead you. I thought you were asking a different question. I would love to talk to you about it. And so, of course, I had all these weird emotions and I was feeling embarrassed and hurt and misunderstood, you know, a lot of things. Sure. But as the week progressed, I started getting really frustrated and angry because I was like, none of it made sense. And I was kind of annoyed by the whole thing. So I wasn't kind of annoyed. I was annoyed. And so fast forward Saturday night of that week, I'm lying on the sofa and I rarely get sick. I've got swollen glands in my neck. I have a fever. I'm not feeling well at all. And my dad's a doc. So I call him up and I said, Dad, you know, I described the symptoms and he goes, oh, wow. He goes, you have the really bad flu going around. And I said, well, what can I do for it? He said, nothing. It's a virus. He said, you just got to wait it out. And I said, well, you know, how long, you know, have your patients had it? He said, this is a bad one. He said, my patients have been sick for 2 weeks on average with this one.
Wow.
And I said, well, I've got a speaking gig out of town on Wednesday. And he goes, you're not going to be there. He said, just go to bed, get some sleep. And I was like, oh. So I go up to bed and it's, again, I'm like dizzy and feverish and whatnot. And I'm laying in bed. Now, I know myself well enough to know that for me, when I get sick, like congested or whatever, that's usually a sign that the words that I need to speak are not coming out, that there's a conversation that I should be having that I'm not having. Now, that's not necessarily true for everybody, but I know for me, that tends to happen.
Sure.
And so and with the swollen glands and the fever, and I knew where it was coming from, the conversation that I needed to have with this guy was never going to happen. Yeah. Now, I know sometimes you can have a thought like that and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, but it wasn't like that at all. I wanted to talk to him and I was open to talking to him, but I knew in my heart, he was never going to go there. I don't know why I knew that. I just knew it. And fair enough, he didn't. He later died, you know, a couple of years later, and we never talked after that, which was sad. But I go up to bed that night, and I literally prayed. I said, God, I need your help. The conversation that I most need to have is never going to happen, and I need to let go of all this anger that I'm feeling because I'm feeling a tremendous amount of anger, and I would just want to let it go. And so I get I get this vision of the Leonardo da Vinci Vitruvian Man, you know, the guy with his arms out and his legs out. And but except for it wasn't the Da Vinci's guy, it was my friend in this hologram. And he's taking, now this guy, he's about 6'5", 300 plus pounds. He's a big dude. And he's taking up the full space in that hologram. But interestingly enough, superimposed on top of him, taking up the exact same amount of space, was my honorary nephew, Steele, who at the time was 3 years old. And I literally laughed out loud. I said, that's a really interesting image, but I don't get it. And I kid you not, the next thing I hear is a voice. It was not a male voice. It was not a female voice. It was just a voice. And it said, he is at the emotional development level of a 3-year-old. It is not his fault. Be more compassionate.
Yeah.
And I like literally let it go in an instant. And to this day, I can honestly tell you, I've never had a second or an ounce of anger or frustration about this situation. I literally let it go. I woke up twice in the middle of the night that night and I had to change clothes because I was drenched. Literally, my body was just purging out all that negative energy and whatnot. I woke up in the morning. I was fine, completely healed.
Wow. Wow. And you know, the idea of that causing a psychosomatic response in your body, the idea of that, once again, that pent up energy that you needed release causing that. I mean, that's quite literally the source of chiropractic, things like that, is to release those energies, to get rid of that kind of stuff. And our listener, Victoria, had a question that popped up. Do you think synchronicities are possibly a gateway to deeper metaphysical work? And I would tend to say that if anything, that they are a confluence of space and time. They are a confluence mm-hmm. of, once again, something that you should pay attention to. So, yeah, I would think that that if you were someone that was a manifestation type of person, that would be your moment to seize on trying to manifest something out of that and trying to turn that manifestation into reality.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I have to really think about that. But I guess my, like with anything else, if your gut's telling you that this is something that you need to look a little deeper on, and it leads you down that path, trust it. Because the only time that I believe that a synchronicity would lead you, or a gut instinct would potentially lead you in the wrong direction or could be misinterpreted, is in a case of fear or greed. Mm. But generally speaking, it's not going to be one of those two things. And so if you get a gut instinct about something, you know, I shouldn't go to this party, I should, you know, do this, I should not do that, the vast majority of the time you can trust that. And so if that's synchronicity is leading you to a deeper pursuit of something that you know in your heart you could do, maybe should do, maybe you have a little fear around, then yeah, why not?
Yeah, precisely.
And fear in that case, not, I don't mean fear, the kind of fear that you shouldn't pay attention to, but the fear of, you know, where anytime you get out of your comfort zone, that's
yeah.
the
what yeah, the reticence and even, you know, the idea of almost feeling it, because we live in a strange society, specifically here in America, Rob. When it comes to how we view things, when it comes to how we are connected to the greater world around us, when it comes to how we are connected generationally, things like that. We are a unique species over here, as opposed to, you know, the Far East, the Middle East, even Europe, things like that. And the attitude towards such things like metaphysics, that kind of stuff, towards such things as manifestation in daily life, the importance of good mental health, you know, the importance of being able to say no, the importance of taking 2.5 weeks of holiday every year, you know, that kind of stuff, where mental wherewithal is the necessity of life. And you have to take care of that. You have to be willing to step aside and, unfortunately, greedily do what you have to do to get what you need to keep your cup filled, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's interesting because going back to that point that you were making about the connection between mind, body and, you know, illness and stuff, I think part of the reluctance of healthcare practitioners to even go there is because you could argue that there's a bit of blaming the victim potentially
sure.
In that moment. Sure. But, you know, it was interesting to me, like with the lymphoma, I vividly remember being in their office, in the oncologist's office, and his nurse practitioner was there. Her name was Betsy. And Betsy was a lovely lady. I liked them all. I mean, they were great bedside manner and everything. But I was very curious because, you know, like I said, my dad was a doc. I was raised yeah. around that kind of thing. And I said, what is known about what causes lymphoma? You know, the kinds of, you know, the kind that I have. And I was asking it like an investigative reporter, not yeah. like anything other than that. And her reaction surprised both of us, I think, because she looked at me and she's like, you didn't cause these. And I'm thinking to myself, that's a really interesting reaction because that wasn't the question that I asked
you. Yeah, that was nowhere near the question.
Yeah, exactly. But what also caught me off guard was the fact that my immediate gut level reaction to what she said is that's not true. And yeah. I don't say this in a blaming myself sort of mentality, but, you know, just to back up, I got diagnosed with the tumors in it was on my birthday in 2015. So it's February 18, 2015. And it was the year before that that I had met a woman that we had, you know, the relationship started and seemed particularly promising. I was very excited about her. And then she did a bit of a disappearing act, and I was devastated. I was just, you know, and I will freely admit that I emotionally circled the drain for the better part of a year.
Sure.
And then the tumors were like this wake-up call. And what was interesting to me was that, you know, the first tumor that I found was right on my other collarbone, interestingly enough. And I thought to myself, because then I got an MRI or whatever you call it, one of the scans.
And yeah,
they
CT scan.
Said, wow, you have tumors all over your neck, yeah. But the primary tumor is a 5x7x8 centimeter tumor that's sitting directly on top of your heart.
Wow.
Well, the symptom in that was not lost on me at all. And I don't blame her, you know, the woman
sure.
at all, because she's not responsible for how I digest life.
That's right.
You know, you could have let it go. You'd have done a better job of that. None of that's on her at all. And she and I are friends to this day. So there's no
good
remaining hard feelings or whatever. But to me, you cannot have negative energy flowing through your body for the better part of a year and expect that you're not going to have a consequence.
Absolutely.
I was just lucky that it was a curable.
Well, and you know, it's interesting, Rob, how those situations drastically change the way that you not only look at life, of course, but the way that you look at things like synchronicities, the way that you look at small connections, the way that you look at the larger web, and the way that when one strand gets struck, the other side of the web moves. And you know, my older brother in the last many years went through the exact same thing, lymphoma, stage 4, to the point that he got the Wolverine treatment, man. Like, they threw him in an isolation wow. booth, and he ended up with a bone marrow transplant. And got a whole new immune system, you know, like took shots for the second time in life that he took at 5 years old, things like that. And it's fascinating to see the spiritual progression of my brother, since, and because we've both looked into esoteric things. We both considered these things. We both had a great connection with spirituality our whole life. But to see him very much exploring it more, to see him very much exploring the connection of these things, the way that these things connect in a larger way in life is awesome and fantastic, yeah. You know, and it's interesting to see how that change occurs, you know?
For sure. How's he doing now, by the way?
Oh, he's fantastic. He's great. Yeah, like he zero, absolute zero whenever he goes in for tests. Not even joking.
Beautiful.
And yourself?
Yeah, great. No, I shouldn't say I knew. There's one of the lessons for me in that was how to experience myself in the face of uncertainty. And I'm not going to say that I went through that with flying colors, because I did not. But it was bookended on both sides with uncertainty around first, what is it? And then secondly, did we get it all? Fortunately, the answers to, you know, those questions were in my favor. So that was great. And they've never used the word remission. They've always said cured, which is great. So I'm good on that front. And my dad, it's funny, because my dad said, he said, you know, when I was in medical school, he said, what you had was a death sentence.
Yeah.
And now they consider it curable, which is why I think, you know, when it comes to cancer, we need a completely new vocabulary, because to use the same word to describe what I had, which I got through. Now, I'm not going to say that 545 hours of chemo was a picnic. It was not. But with relative ease. And then you compare that to, you know, somebody who's got pancreatic cancer and finds out they've got, you know, 6 weeks to live. It's a disservice to the other person to use the same word to describe that illness, because it's not
right.
the same thing.
That's right. And you know, it's once again fascinating to see the way that not just facing your mortality, but facing a situation that is fully beyond your control on so many levels.
And that's why
actively changes the way that you are connected to the world around you.
Totally. And I was very fortunate that I had a couple of mentors, my friend Shen Robinson and my friend Jackie Hart. Jackie was going through stage four cancer at that point.
Oh, wow.
And she and I used to talk a lot about, you know, the journey. And one of the things that both of those women impressed on me was the importance of how you speak about something like that. Because you'll hear people use words, you know, like the word that I avoided was have. You never heard me say that I had anything related to that. Because when you say you have something, that's a possession. It's something you're holding on to.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we talked about I'm experiencing tumors. I'm walking with, you know, that was the. And I never felt like I was fighting it. The idea of kicking cancer's ass, whatever, that was not on my radar. Because it's my attitude from the beginning pretty much was, this has come to teach me a lesson. We got to figure out, my goal is to figure out what the lesson is, to walk with it, you know, treat it like the gift that it is, and then move on. Now, is it a gift for everybody? No. That's why I say, you know, we need a new vocabulary around it, because what I received as a gift, other people actually do receive as a guest death sentence. Now, part of that, though, also, you know, goes back to, you know, are you, you know, how much of a role is your attitude playing in the whole process?
Absolutely.
I think, you know, the fact that I got through what I got through, and really, because I remember Shen actually at one point, she sent me a private message and she said, you know, because she was reading my Facebook posts and they were often very funny about things that were happening and whatnot. And she's like, you know, Rob, how are you doing really? And I'm like, no, really, I'm fine. I was as happy, this is going to sound weird, that was the happiest I've ever been in my whole life.
Wow.
Because I was surrounded by love and I felt, and I had never let myself feel anything like that before.
Yeah.
And so that's when I realized the tears of joy were real. I thought that was just something that people said. I didn't think it was real. And then when I found out they were real, I was like, wow, this is amazing. You know, because it was beautiful. Now, would I want to go through that again? No, definitely not. Don't get the wrong idea. But you know, it was something that I'm so grateful that it happened.
Well, and, you know, we have about 8-9 minutes, something like that, left in the interview, Rob. With that time, sans a cancer experience, sans a major religious upheaval or questioning of life in somebody's life, how does somebody begin to recognize synchronicities as they happen in their life? How do people begin to recognize synchronicities as they happen in their dreams? And how do they begin to bring those to fruition?
So the biggest and most important part of that whole thing is making a note of it, and not just a mental note of it, but really writing it down. And if you don't do it, you don't necessarily have to write it down by hand, although that helps. With dreams, when I started my dream journal, I would remember, you know, one or two dreams a night, maybe if I was lucky. By doing it every day for a period of time, there were times that I had 7, 8, 10 dreams that I could remember the details of from one night.
Wow.
And so if you want to, you know, catch the signs, you've got to be paying attention to it. So on the dream side, keeping a dream journal is one of them. On the synchronicity side, one of the things I do on my phone, whenever I see something that is a, you know, synchronicity, I'm thinking of a particular city and there's the name of the city, or I'm thinking of a person and, you know, the song shows up, you know, I'll take a picture of it. And I have a whole file in my phone. One of the albums is Signs and Synchronicities. And so, and it's really fun to go back and look at some of them, because then, oh yeah, you know, that did happen. You know, I was thinking, you know, there was one time I was thinking of my friend Josie, and Rick Beato was doing, that was the day that he was doing a thing on the song Josie by Steely Dan.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And when I, that was the little screensaver thing, or whatever you want to call it, that when I opened YouTube, that was what I saw. The very first thing I saw was Josie by Steely Dan.
Awesome. Awesome. And you know, once again, that idea of once you've begun seeing these things, once you've begun recognizing them, once you've begun, I guess, kind of heeding them as they happen in your life and abiding by them, You know, that idea of just letting them be, understand them, see them, recognize them. How do you bring them to fruition? How do you learn to understand the greater significance behind them, Rob?
That's an interesting question, because I think part of it is paying attention and talking to other people who are into it and who are in tune and getting, you know, a sense from other people. Because sometimes a lot of the insights that I'll get, I've got friends who are very intuitive and I'll, you know, talk to them about that kind of thing. But like sometimes you get the right angel at the right moment. So example that when I was going through the tumors, I went in for a PET scan, and that's one of those ones where they see where all the tumors are and how far along they are or whatever. And I was waiting for the result. You know, I obviously don't get the results instantly. So I got back in the car, and I'm, you know, at this point, we don't know really what the tumors are or, you know, what the ultimate prognosis is. And I get in the car and I turn on the radio, and the very first song that comes on is Don't Fear the Reaper by the Blue Oyster Cult. And of course, that sends a shockwave of terror through my body, because I'm like, oh my God. And Robbie Schaefer, this friend of mine, he's a fantastic songwriter from the band Eddie from Ohio. He calls me at that very minute. And I go, God, am I glad you just called? I said, you're never going to believe what just happened. And I told him that I just had this test. And I get in the car and the song's on. And he bursts out laughing. And he goes, never doubt that the universe has a sense of humor.
That's right.
I love it, because I hadn't been thinking of it as a cosmic joke. I mean, you know, the fear in me catastrophized. It was like, oh my God, is this, you know, the universe's way of telling me to, you know, make sure that I've got my house in order, you know, from a will standpoint.
Yeah.
And he's like, there was no question in his mind that it was just a joke. And he was right. But I wouldn't have thought of that.
Too funny. Too funny. Rob, thank you so much for coming on, for talking about this topic, for being so honest and forthcoming about your personal experience and what led you to these personal changes and to writing this amazing book. I cannot wait to finish the rest of it. I've once again read almost the first 100 pages since I got it yesterday, and I can't wait. It's fantastic. And once again, the idea of learning to be in connection with a world greater than yourself. I've told people for years, I don't care if you go to church on a Sunday. I don't care if it's the dog next door or the tree next door. As long as you are in touch with something greater than yourself in the universe. Let's start there. Let's all agree to start there, you know, as a common peg. So thank you so much for your time tonight. Thank you so much for your candidness. I greatly appreciate it. Before we let you go, let everyone know where they can go to get their copy of A Trek Within, where they can go to tune into the show, when they can tune into the show, and where they can keep up with everything that is Rob Ryan Sullivan.
Great. Well, thank you. I appreciate that opportunity. Yeah, atrekwithin.com is the website. And for people who are on the fence about whether or not this is, you know, resonates with them fully, you can go there and download a free chapter of the book. Actually, it's a couple. It's like the foreword and an intro and a chapter, some other stuff. And also you could download the audio, because I did the recording.
A
friend suggested that, because she's like, Rob, I could listen to your stories all day. And she inspired me to do an audio book. So you can download a free chapter of the audio book as well and just kind of see if it's something that you are interested in. If it is, then you can buy it on Amazon. You can, any local independent bookstore can order it. So pretty much anywhere. The Trek Within podcast, YouTube, any of the big podcast platforms, you should be able to find it. And that's really the big thing. That podcast, because every 2 weeks right now we're doing a new episode, and it's fun because it's not just, you know, I've interviewed psychics. I've got some musicians coming up, which I'm really excited about. We're going to talk about creativity. I've had people on from MUFON, the UFO network,
nice.
You know, just a lot of different topics. So it's not any one thing, you know, every time. And some of the people who shared stories in the book, because it's not just about me, there's a ton of people, you know, who shared stories. Some of them have been guests on the podcast as well.
Absolutely. And it's a great show. Once again, a very organic show with great topics, great conversation on there, Rob. Thank you so much for the conversation tonight. I greatly appreciate it. I'll be in touch with links, all of that good stuff. Thank you so much for being on.
I appreciate you. Have a good one.
Take care. While you are online checking out everything from Rob Ryan Sullivan over at atrekwithin.com, everybody, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. Curious Realm is where you can find all of the video channels of our guests at curiousrealm.com/video. That is also where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can find your connection to Ground Zero Media and Ground Zero Radio. If you like this show, there are tons of shows like that, like this, on Ground Zero Radio, and you can support us by supporting them because we are a network family member. So stop on by, check us out if you are a Ground Zero Radio member. Friday nights, 6 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Central, just before Clyde Lewis. So when we come back from this commercial break, everybody, we will be joined by our good friend Jason Quitt, author of Gates of the Anunnaki. We will be talking about a brand new article that he has coming out that really simplifies the understanding of solar and lunar alignments that are expressed within artifacts, carvings, paintings, hieroglyphs, all kinds of things. All of that and more when we get back from this quick commercial break right after this.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and thank you so much for staying tuned through that quick commercial break. Also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially the amazing True Hemp Science. They are your source and my source for amazing CBD. I have been recommended for years by my doctor for CBD use for my travel anxiety, for my regular anxiety daily, and they are by far the best company that I have found. They use a full spigyric process where every part of the plant is used, combusted, and reused all the way down to literal dust, where every part of the plant and the benefits from it can be drawn out. They have amazing terpene profiles, some of the only stuff I've ever found with terpene profiles. So stop on by and check them out. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to find your amazing products. And if you use the code Curious7, you will save 7% off of your entire cart of $50 or more and get two free edibles on the way out the door. Our guest in this segment is the amazing Jason Quitt. His website is thecrystalsun.com. He has been on with us before talking about his awesome and amazing book, The Gates of the Anunnaki. He is back on today to talk more about sacred alignments, what they are, why they exist, and how they are passed down through generation, especially through temple building. Welcome back to the show, Jason Quitt. How are you, my friend?
Doing great. It's always good to be back here and to share this knowledge with you and everybody that's listening.
Man, your work, I follow a lot of researchers. I follow a lot of people who are like out boots on the ground at ruins and locations, Jason. Your work is some of the most groundbreaking that I have seen in the last decade, man, when it comes to not just the connection of temple complexes across the globe, but the way that these sacred geometries are passed along, the way that these sacred geometries are passed down, because I don't think a lot of people realize the absolute importance that these things had, not just mystically, but to everyday life, to the people that used them, to the people that, like these sacred spots like Stonehenge, these sacred places like what we're going to be getting into tonight, you know, the Great Pyramid of Egypt, things like that. These huge, massive monuments that we don't know how they were built, but we know that they were massively important, and we still kind of don't know why. But when you start getting into the way that these things transmit the knowledge of the cycle of the sun, the cycle of the moon, the cycle of the stars, that, like we say on the show all the time, this was vital to the economy and to the ecology of ancient man. If you didn't know these things, you starved in the winter. You didn't know where to go plant crop, when to plant crop. You didn't know where to go hunt during certain times of the year. If you didn't know the story of the skies and why Orion was rising in the sky right now at dusk, you know, these things were massively important. And what better way to pass them on and make sure that they're there for eons than to build them in stone? So your work is awesome. It's absolutely amazing, and I've still got goosebumps from what we were talking about pre-show. So, how did you first get into this research, Jason? How did you first come across these sacred alignments that you have found?
You know what? The truth is, I completely stumbled upon it, and you know, my background and what I've been talking about for years has been about spiritual journeys, about shamanic journeys, has been about altered states of consciousness, out-of-body experiences, contact experiences, and ancient history, and how it all kind of relates and connects to all these things. Mm. And the very strange thing about it is that, you know, I was writing this book, which is The Egyptian Postures of Power, which is about mysticism, meditation, movements, all this great stuff. And because I really wanted to include the original mystery teachings of Egypt, I wanted to include basically the point of view or the perspective of these ancient people and what they believed in thousands of years ago. And the way that we can do that is because we have these ancient texts. Like, everybody knows the Book of the Dead, the Egyptian Book of the Dead, the weighing of the heart, you know, the afterlife. We know that the afterlife is very important to the pharaohs and to just the regular people in Egypt. And there was lots of rituals, lots of beliefs tied into that, especially with mummification, burial rituals, and even the tombs themselves. So for me to write this book, I said, okay, I have to just reread these. So, you know, reread, you know, the Books of the Gates, the Hours, the Egyptian Book of the Dead. And my absolute favorite that I keep going back to continually is the Pyramid Texts of Unas. Mm. And the reason why the pyramid texts are so important is because they're literally the oldest scripture that we have available to us. It goes back to basically the exact same time they tell us they built the pyramids. So it's about 2400 BC. So about 4,400 years ago, we have these texts called the pyramid texts, which were etched in stone into the pyramid. Now, I keep going back and forth reading these texts, trying to understand the significance about it. And what I found that was very interesting is that when you go back to the furthest that we know, which is the pyramid texts, it has to do with the pharaoh journeying through the afterlife. And remember, there's these two levels of information. You have the knowledge that's taught to the pharaohs or the priestly class. And then you have the information that is taught to the normal everyday people. It's kind of what we have today with, you know, just regular priests. So there's scripture for them and scripture for us, or a different type of understanding of those scriptures. So why the pyramid texts are so important from my perspective is that it was only meant for the pharaoh to read this and know these scripts. And basically it talks about how when they journey into the afterlife, it's all about going to heaven, which was the stars in the sky. And that as they would pass through different stars, those stars represented the gods. And as you pass through those stars, you yourself become the gods. You know, and I posted a quote today on Twitter and on Facebook, and I saw that you shared it too. But basically it talks about how, I'm going to have to go back to the actual quote of this.
That's okay.
I don't know if that's my beeping Skype or your beeping Skype, but it doesn't matter.
Oh, I'm not beeping. Okay. At least I don't think so.
So as long as it's not getting on the mastery.
No, but it is not.
Okay. So, I'll just quote this. It says, you shall become completed as every god. Your head as Horus, your face as the eyes forward as the imperishable star, your ears, Adam's twins, an imperishable star. And it goes through all these gods and saying that as you pass it, your body becomes the stars in the sky, which are the gods. You know, when you go into later texts, it kind of separates from that. And it's like you're facing the gods. But in this text, you're becoming the gods, you know, so completely different perspective.
Well, and, you know, you bring up a very, very interesting point, which is that there was a different set of knowledge, even within the stories of the gods, between the common people and the high priests. A prime example, even later of this in life, would be one of the psalms that we read regularly in the seminary was, you know, to be a priest as in the days of Melchizedek of old. And the idea that the high priests of Melchizedek had a different connection to the divine and a different understanding of these sacred things than the average priesthood. And even more than the average practitioner who came into the temple and the average attendee. You know, they were all told the same stories, but their intimate knowledge of these stories and what that symbology meant was something totally different to the initiate than to the attendee.
Exactly. And this is what I really want to make abundantly clear to people that research this information, is that there was different classes of information. And also, you know, even when we look back at the Babylonian texts, compared to Akkadian and then Sumerian, these stories evolved. So, you know, we can go back to, let's say, the earliest that we have, which is around Sumeria Akkadian. And we can look at, let's say, the Epic of Gilgamesh, for example. And then we can go further down in history, towards the present, which was later on in Babylon. And then you have the gods that change in the Enuma Elish. And then there's a completely different creation story there. So you have researchers that kind of like pick and choose. Okay, I feel like this creation myth better suits my theories. And they push the other stories aside. But the way that I look at it, it's like the older it goes back is, you know, you find the roots of where these things came from. And then as you study these texts, you see how they evolve in different places and different times and how they were used to, let's say, rally the people.
Yeah.
You know, and this is why, you know, it went from the Anunnaki, let's say like the gods of Enki and Enlil, who are like the supreme deities back then for their towns. And then suddenly in Babylon, it switched and it's now Marduk, you know, and then a new life came to Babylon when they chose that new god. So there is this kind of like relationship between these religious beliefs and statehood or stateship, and how to, I would say, rally the people. I don't want to say control the people, but give them a path.
Well,
almost.
Well, you don't want to say control, but there was definitely a means of control there, you know, and especially whenever you're talking about the non-reticence of an incoming pharaoh to eradicate the sculptures of a previous pharaoh, to wipe their face off of things, stuff like that. It was a pretty common practice, you know, to come in and go pride lion, and as you came in, destroy everything from the previous pharaoh to make sure that, you know, their face was defamed, the teachings that they came up with were defamed and moved along. And you know, it's kind of like when people think that, once again, the idea that even the hieroglyphs that we see have different meaning depending on where they are. You know, the ones that are written down have a totally different nomenclature to them, the ones on papyrus, than the ones that are carved. And the ones that were, even the fact of hieroglyphic language was not the same as the written language at the time. You know, it's kind of like saying that Latin was the common language of Rome. No, it wasn't. It was not a spoken language. It was a legal language for writing and for the ecclesiastic class. That was it.
And have you ever picked up an English book that's like a couple hundred years old?
Yeah.
Can you even read that?
Yeah.
Can you understand a sentence?
Yeah. Yeah. And even the fact of, like, you know, S's look like lowercase F's and things like that. You know, the writing style was different. The typography was different. Things like that. So when you start especially looking at things like what the common people who were helping build the pyramids were reading on the daily, and what the priestly class who were in charge of building the pyramids were reading, were similar, but the meanings were esoterically broken down in totally different ways.
Absolutely. And you have to kind of go back and put yourself in the mindset. And, you know, my research, or where I'm really looking, is languages change. You know, Egypt stood for thousands of years. There was a lot of changes that took place. There's many, you know, the different periods of Egypt, different pharaohs, different styles, like you were saying, even different warring classes came in and took over certain things.
Yeah.
So you have all these different influences. And even though the story changes, you know, so we can go through historical texts and we can see an evolution, and we understand, yes, it's still Egyptian. Yes, it's still using the same gods, but the stories kind of change depending on the purpose of why they're changing them.
Yeah.
But they do change. And my whole thing is, how do they transmit knowledge from generation to generation over thousands of years without using a language or without using what a known language is, what I'll say. And I got this idea that there's this universal language, and the universal language is the stars. And, you know, we have television, we have our smartphones today. Back then, if you needed to know something, you had to look at the stars. To find your place in the world, you had to look up and you had to know where the North Star was. You had to know where the sun was rising, where it was setting. You had to know all these different things to know exactly where you were in the cycles of the world. And if you did not have that knowledge, you would be it's a survival thing. Your generations would probably not survive if you did not understand this information. So the greatest knowledge ever held by humanity is the understandings of cycles. And how do you calculate cycles? Well, we have the most incredible cosmic clock ever, which is the moon, which is the sun, with the planets and the stars. And you would have to look at the heavens sometimes for thousands of years and record the movements of certain stars. Like, if you go back to Egypt, for example, The rising of Sirius aligns with the year, the sun, the solar cycle. And I'm trying to remember the exact date in my mind, but I believe it only happens once every 1,461 years. All right. So that means they had to watch Sirius for at least 14,000 plus years, or sorry, 1,400 plus years,
yeah,
to realize that it comes back to the same spot and matches the rising of the sun. So that is how they align Sirius with the solar cycle of 365 days. We're talking thousands of years ago they figured this out by following that star. And they recently just decoded the Mayan calendars. And that was just this year. Because I believe that they could not understand this 20-year cycle. It was just too complicated. They couldn't understand. And finally, they broke it down that this 20-year cycle had to do with the alignment of certain planets and cycles. So they would even follow the different planets.
Yeah.
Like, this is crazy. Like, what we're looking at is extremely complex, because you had to have had trained observers following the heavens.
Yep.
And it had to have lasted generations.
And see, here's the thing though. And this is what I think modern people tend to forget, Jason. We have a very, very modern equivalent of this, thanks to a man named Ben Franklin. And it's called the Farmer's Almanac. All right. Where you can just about pretty regs pick up a farmer's almanac in a toilet and pretty much tell what your winter's going to be like, my man. Like, you don't need to tune into the news. We know through hundreds of years of observations of cycles, winter cycles, that when the summer does this and the spring does this, you can probably expect for a long winter. You know, you can expect for winter to start earlier this year. You can expect for this. And these are things that farmers live and die by, man. I've had farmers in my families for years, and they will trust that almanac over a weatherman any day of the week. Because it is a cyclical thing, and it's something that even ancients realized, the fact that we were living in a cycle. And once again, if you weren't tied to that, you were going to die. It wasn't a, oh, you know, maybe I'll lose half a crop. Like, your whole civilization has no corn, man. And especially when you're talking about a civilization like the Egyptians, who lived and died by the swells of the Nile. You know, I mean, Egypt itself, as we heard from Mike Ricksecker last week, the name itself meant black earth, you know. And it was because of the black silt that came up from the Nile that made everything so lush and fertile, you know? So if you didn't know when that was going to happen because of astronomical means, you were either going to be flooded as a society,
yeah,
or you weren't going to have crop that year. One of the two was going to happen.
And you have to think shamanically, like,
that's right.
You know, we look back at these ancient gods and we're like, you know, why is this god a snake? You know, why does this god have a head of a falcon? Why does this god have a head of a dog? You know, there are actual reasons for why that is. Mm. And it has to do with this kind of shamanic hybridization of what is going on the planet. So like you just said, you know, why are snakes so important in Egypt? Well, one example is that they burrow and they have their homes close to the Nile, the river. And when it rains, when you get the rainy season, when it starts to flood, those snakes escape. They leave
and they
their habitats. And they try to find shelter. And where do they find the shelters? In the temples and in the homes of the people.
That's right. In your pile of clothes.
So you wake up one day and suddenly your house is full of snakes or spiders or scorpions.
Yeah.
And you're like, what the hell, man? Like, oh, it's the gods.
Yeah.
the gods are now going to bring life to the earth because the snakes are now in my pajamas.
Yeah.
You know, these are all signs. So how would you say it's the same thing like with the dogs, like Anubis, for example. He's the god of the underworld. He's the god of funerary rites. He's the god that protects the dead and makes sure the dead get through. And he will stand with you in the afterlife. And the dogs are nocturnal hunters. So they're in the dark and they howl at the moon. You know, so
yeah.
They were seen as a connection to the afterlife. They were seen as a connection to the moon. They were seen as all these things because they are nocturnal hunters and you audibly hear them in the night howling.
Yeah.
You know, so that's where they get their characteristics from. It's the same thing as Horus, where, you know, Horus is the sky and the sun. And when you look up into the heavens, you have this beautiful bird that flies across the sky just like the sun. So you get these kind of like morphogenic hybridization of this knowledge. It's you know, the same thing with the toes. If you go to the Het gods or the Ogdid gods, the eight primordial forces in Egypt, you'll see them as snakes and frogs, mostly. Snakes and frog beings. And, you know, when do you hear the frogs? It's at nighttime.
Yeah.
They come to life. You know, so it's like you have these connections to these things. So this is kind of like where my research has taken me. And not only is there this shamanic connection of, you know, why they chose certain gods to look like certain animals. They chose certain gods to represent different time periods of the cycles. So you would have one god during the rainy cycle. You have one god during the cycle of harvest, cycle of summer, the heat. So depending on where the sun or the moon was in relation to the stars, you had a different deity because there was different things happening in the heavens and on earth. Hmm. So they would kind of create these deities, which were then given personifications and stories that related to specific times on the earth, just like an almanac.
Yeah.
So when you honor this god at this festival, it's because it's the harvest festival. You know, and this is the god that oversees the harvest.
Well, you know, once again, the beauty of what you have done with your work, Jason, is to take this literal esoteric knowledge that was passed down once again from high priest to high priest, that kind of stuff, from a religious ruling class to another religious, because that's who people went to. Didn't matter if it was the king trying to have his dreams interpreted, or if the king wanted to go to war, or if the king wanted to know what the harvest was going to be this year. You went to the high priest is who you went to. That is who had your answer to how these questions related to the world around you, period. And that's who you lived and died by. So when your high priest said something, you tended to listen, you know, and the fact that the knowledge of these priests has been through generations, through various cultures, embedded into the artwork and embedded into the sacred spaces that they built and that they directed the construction of is absolutely beautiful and amazing. And one of the ways that you show this, you have an article that's getting ready to be published that I cannot wait till it's published. Cause like I said, I think it's really going to simplify a lot of this stuff for a lot of people and also expose this to the world of academia and archaeology that's out there. Because when you start looking at, we'll start off right here, with what you're seeing on screen right now for it to narrate for those who are listening is an image of the Great Pyramid of Giza from above at a very specific time of day where the shadow is being cast in any direction other than directly overhead, where you can see the fact that the Great Pyramid of Giza is not a four-sided object. It's an eight-sided object. It's an octahedron, you know, and it's the fact that there is such a subtle angle in the middle of each facet that you cannot see it until shadow is cast. And it's pretty phenomenal, to think about the precision at which it took to build the Great Pyramid of Giza to begin with on that kind of scale, but also to build it with the precision and scale that it is that, not just a four-sided, but it's an eight-sided.
It's object. Offset by 1 degree.
1 degree. It's, on every side.
You can't, like, when you're in front of it, it's very difficult to even see it. From the air, you can see it.
Well, even then, from the air, you really need shadow to see it, it well. You can kind of see a divide, because, like, you can kind of see here, as I'm highlighting this side, you can kind of see a dividing line. You can see it here on the side that the sun is really coming from, but once you see it, I mean, the full shaded side, you see none of it. But this one, like, you can definitely see the two different colors being cast by the sun, you know, which, you know, once you get into equilibrium, equinox, things like that, that really and truly drive the harvesting patterns of things and how you plant. That's that, like, you couldn't get a better sundial as to be like, plant now. day you see this happen, start sowing in the ground. You know,
exactly. It's a timekeeping device. It's a megalithic timekeeping device that they could look at visually to see what time of year it is.
Yeah.
And most people will never understand that, but that is exactly what it is. And I've heard the argument saying that this means nothing. And the reason it means nothing is because they had casing stones on top of this that would hide that, you know. And then I'm thinking, I'm like, well, if that's true, that the casing stones would hide that feature, could it mean that the casing stones were placed on top to prevent, to maybe protect an ancient relic that was before that culture?
Mm.
You know, no one's really thought of that one before.
Yeah. Yeah. And even once again, the idea that the pyramids themselves very, very well align with Orion in the night sky, you know, and specifically with the rise of Orion in the night sky and Orion's belt.
Orion was a very important constellation.
Yeah.
Very important. And, you know, when we go to, when we actually grid and understand the Giza Plateau with the pyramids as a timekeeping device, a secret of the pyramid comes out, which is the sun sets on the back of the Sphinx during the equinoxes. So this is a very important visual representation of the equinoxes, and it shows that the entire Sphinx and the Giza Plateau was laid out to highlight the equinox, just like the other just like the other temples and pyramids found around the world, especially in Mesoamerica, where you have now the name is escaping me, but basically there's a pyramid with the shadows of the serpents that come alive.
Hmm.
During the equinox.
Chichen Itza.
Chichen Itza, yes. So you have these pyramids set up to specifically be aligned with cycles of time, to show visually that that something is happening, that it is exactly 12 hours of day and 12 hours of night being equal. Another very interesting thing, when you also look at the geometry of the pyramids, it actually, the smallest period, the Menkaure pyramid, which is the furthest to the left in the Giza Plateau, it is aligned exactly the peak from the Sphinx to the peak of the Menkaure Pyramid is 18.5 degrees from the equinox. Mm. And 18.5 degrees is the lunar It's the minor lunar standstill, which is a cycle that happens every 18.6 years. So every 18.6 years, the moon will actually set directly at the peak of the Menkaure pyramid. And I don't think anybody has said that.
That is fascinating. And especially once you start considering, like you said, once you start considering the entire Giza Plateau as one huge timekeeper.
Yeah.
To be able to look at those things, to be able to see those things, to be able to cyclically ring in certain times of year, certain religious ceremonies, certain times to plant things like that. It makes perfect sense. It makes a lot more sense than most explanations out there. And, you know, go ahead.
You have to listen to them. And this is what drives me nuts, is that you really have to listen to them. And it comes through their theology. It comes through their beliefs. You know, if you go back to the creation story, you know, it talks about, you know, Ra is in the abyss, which is like the dark waters. Mm-hmm. And he speaks his own name and he rises out of the water like the light. And he comes up and his light shines on the first earth mound, which is called the Benben stone. And so his light illuminates the Benben stone. And it says that the Benben stone is in the shape of a pyramid, right? So a pyramid shape is not only the symbol of creation, it's the symbol of the sun, of light, all right? Now think about this for a second. We're seeing the pyramids as like a solar clock and a lunar clock right now. That's what we're looking at as a timekeeping device. But think of an obelisk. You have this huge obelisk standing up in front of the pyramids in the temples. And at the top of the obelisk is a pyramid, you know, or a pyramid shape. Mm. Now think about this for a second. During the first moments of the sunrise, everything is still in shadow except the tip of the obelisk. So you can measure the exact time of sunrise by the light illuminating the tip of the obelisk.
Mm.
You know, nobody thinks about these things.
Yeah.
But if you go back and you read the symbolic nature of these texts, it tells you how these objects relate to creation, relate to light, relate to timekeeping.
Yeah. Well, and especially just the fact of the entire symbology of an obelisk to begin with is supposed to be the ray of light coming down from the sun.
Yeah.
You know, so to think of that pyramid shape being the origin point of the connection of the beam of light and the sun itself is fantastically simplistic.
Why do we complicate these things?
Yeah.
Is the question.
Well, you know, and it kind of bears the question to begin with, Jason, because we often want a more complicated answer. You know, we want a more complicated answer than we could build them.
Yeah.
You know, like for some reason it boggles people's mind that ancient people could build these things, or that they had the knowledge of angular construction in that kind of way. And it's like, you know what they didn't have? They didn't have all of these distractions that we have. They grew things and they lived, and the people who studied this is all they studied. This is all they did was, okay, everybody else in the town is going to sleep. The sun observation guy's going to sleep too. I'm going to take over the nighttime star watch. You know, like they had an entire classification of people and strata of people who watched this and chronicled it for this exact purpose.
And, you know, today we talk about like de-evolution. Mm. Like people just aren't smart as like, even though we have more people, we have lots of technology in a modern world.
More access to data, more access to raw knowledge.
Right. But back then, you know, I think the knowledge was held very closely to certain individuals and groups, and it wasn't shared. So most of the population would not know or understand any of this stuff. And, you know, when you look at classical academia, well, you know, if you just type in simply into Google, you know, when was the discovery of the Earth's axial tilt? It'll give you a really interesting answer. And it'll give you three people. It should give you three people. And they're all Greek, Greek astronomers. And basically, it only goes back the furthest to about 300 BC. About 300 BC. And it talks about how they measured a sundial's shadow on the summer solstice. And by measuring the angle of the shadow of summer solstice, that's where they got the first somewhat measurement of the axial tilt of the Earth. And then it wasn't until the next guy, you know, Greek names are very difficult for me to pronounce. I'm not even going to try. But the next guy who figured out the circumference of the Earth, he also figured out the Earth's tilt. And this was about 300 years after this. And then after that, you have another person in Greek, a Greek astronomer, who then says this person was right. You know, that's our history of how this is. And it's really interesting because me, Jason Quitt, just some guy that you're interviewing, I can prove that they knew all of these calculations thousands of years before these people. 100% provable, I could prove this.
Yeah.
It's so obvious once you understand these things. But the math that they used incorporated these angles for them to do these things. So they had to have known them. They weren't guessing. They knew exactly what it was. And they encoded it within the artwork itself, within the architecture itself. And, you know, to even say this, it's kind of weird to even go and say this publicly, it's controversial.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is massively controversial, man. And because it, for some reason, people seem to think that it flies in the face of science. And even when a prime example is, you know, the work of Graham Hancock and his exposures over the last couple of years and the literal attacks on him from mainstream archaeology. And he literally has to back them up and be like, yo, wait a minute. When did I ever say I was a scientist?
Yeah. It's like, who are you?
I'm no scientist. I'm sorry if this flies in the face of what you're teaching, and I'm sorry if my skills as an investigative reporter lead me down a path of clues that tend to contradict what science is saying. That's, I'm just going where the data leads me. And if you keep following the data, it's pretty interesting to see these things. It's pretty interesting to see the common connection of these angular delineations that you're pointing out, 23 degrees, 18 degrees, these lunar angles, solar angles, stuff like that. Once again, depicted in cultures across the world in their artwork and their construction, everything else. So now does that predicate the fact that there's a master builder race that's sharing this with all of them? No, not necessarily. But it is pretty fascinating to look at the fact that whether you're talking culture in India, whether you're talking culture in, you know, Australia, all of these things in their depictions and their pictographs and things like that, they are using the same angular form. And it's pretty interesting to see them using that same lunar angle, that same solar angle that you're talking about amongst all of this stuff.
Yeah. And I find it incredibly interesting because, you know, in all my books, I always talk about the ancestors and I speak about them as the ancestral people of those lands, right? I don't go on the the Atlantis timeline at all. I don't go on to any of those things. And, you know, to even hint that there may have been smarter people further back in time, suddenly you're labeled as like a racist by academics. And the things are so precise, the angles are so precise, that it is a knowledge that is so ancient that we don't know how far back it goes, because we keep finding examples of it going back in time. And before we started this show, I showed you an artifact that was about 25,000 years old that has these geometries in them that tell a story of the moon, you know?
Yeah.
And to understand that story of the moon, or to understand those angles of the moon, you have to be a trained observer. You had to know like certain mathematical skills, and then translate those mathematical skills into geometry to create an image.
Yeah.
And how do you wrap your mind around that going back 25,000 years ago?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just it. Like, I cannot wait until you make more bridges with that one, man, because it's there. With the angular work that you have done, not just in Gates of the Anunnaki, but in Postures of Power and things like that, it is really, really phenomenal the amount of work that you expose, and that you show the connection of between sacred geometry and the angular building of our predecessors, you know?
Yeah. So there's only a couple choices we have here. Well, the first choice is we come to the conclusion that they did have this information. Mm. And then once we understand that they did have this information going back much further than anybody's ever thought, we ask ourselves, is this a common heritage of humanity itself? As in, do our ancestors have a connection far enough back where they all had the same information?
Yeah.
Or, like you said, there's this kind of master builder race, or civilization. I don't want to say race.
I mean,
you know, a master builder civilization, that it goes in connection with what Graham Hancock's and many other people are trying to say, is that, you know, was there a group called, or a group civilization, that after a terrible calamity on the earth, something horrible happened, took it upon themselves to find the remnants of humanity left over from this apocalyptic whatever happened, and then reteach them how to survive. And to reteach them how to survive, what did they teach them? The stars, the cycles, the geometry, the math, the, you know, all these things. Like this example you have up here, which is a really interesting example. This is pre-dynastic. This is very old, over 5,000 years old. And they have these very strange heads. So people are like, okay, they're like bird people or aliens or things like this.
Yeah.
And, you know, what are birds? They fly in the sky. What flies in the sky? It's the sun. And, you know, why are their heads shaped very specifically in very specific angles? And this figure, it has how many? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It has 6 notches on each side, giving a total of 12. And the beak is exactly 15 degrees, and 15 degrees is the division of the sky per hour. So could this be a measuring tool, of a solar measuring tool of the 12 hours of day during the equinox?
Oh, yeah. Or even the middle being the 13th and it being a lunar measuring tool.
So all we know is that we have these artifacts that not one person has come forward to say, here's an explanation. They would just call them idols.
Yeah.
You know? And my thing is that these are not idols. These are tools that provide knowledge of the cycles. And they're designed in a very specific way to hold knowledge. You know, so this would be kind of like a goddess figure. Mm. And these this goes back 4,000 years. This is Hittite. You know, so we have these very strange artifacts that make absolutely no sense. But once you measure them, they all seem to have the same pattern within them.
Yeah.
Cross-culturally, exactly the same pattern.
This one right here is one of my personal favorites that you have decoded, because it is such a ubiquitous picture that has been used so many different places for so many things to talk about so many different things. But when you break down this picture with the angles and what they mean and solar information and lunar information, like, it makes utter sense, especially when you're talking about the angular relation of the stars with the constellation of it, and yes, and with the with its alignment to the constellation Leo that it's literally standing on top of. And that's just it. When you start breaking these things apart, and when you start looking at like the sun rising in Leo and this thing being here, like the relation of them together in the night sky, just as a backyard astronomer, hugely important as far as being able to recognize the motion of these things as they move through the year.
Let me see if I could bring up my copy of that, because I've since updated it.
I was gonna say, I'm sure there's much more annotation in there now.
There's well, let me just see if I can do this, because the reason I want to do this, oh, I don't know why that happened. Okay. I'll have to fix it live for everybody to see.
Okay.
But what I am about to show you is the updated thing, because I've been really trying to make these as correct as humanly possible for no error. I don't know if I can grab this.
There we go.
All right. So
there's the original that you had.
This is the original.
Just so I can A-B them next to each other. So there's the original, and here is his updated work, folks.
Yeah. So basically, like, you can see the rods here. They're like, so exacting that you can't make this stuff up. The arm is so exacting at 18.5 degrees. What I want to say, what's really interesting, and this is why I wanted to kind of zoom in. I'm going to take this off, or I'll move this. You see this necklace thing?
Yeah.
She's wearing this necklace. I'm going to try to zoom in here so you can see this.
Go ahead.
I'm not making this stuff up here. Got to see this necklace, because I don't really talk about this. It's kind of like this M with this like fish thing here.
Yeah.
What is the symbol for Virgo?
I was just about to say that is somebody that's the Virgin.
Yeah. Virgo the Virgin. That is literally the symbol of Virgo.
Yeah.
You can look look up online.
It is the letter M going down with the ichthys on the side.
Yes.
With a fish. That is, I'll bring it up right now so that everybody can see it up against that. But that is fascinating, man.
Because this is another rabbit hole, because, you know, we're talking about zodiac signs here, and most people don't know when those signs are created.
Yeah.
Well, this is the Virgin. So it's exactly the same. It's just, it's the inverted thing.
Yeah.
So this is an inverted imprint of it. It's a cylinder seal.
Yeah. Yeah.
But this image is 4,500 or close to 5,000 years old. So one of the oldest cylinder seals of Inanna. So it's like, how do we come to terms with this information? That's all I have to say. How do we come to terms with this information?
Well, because once again, it is massively important to understand. Even the fact of understanding in the side note there, of understanding that, hey, wait a minute, this is an impression of a scroll. So what you're looking at is actually an inverse.
Yes.
You know, and that's hugely important to understand that it's this image, but reversed, that's on her necklace, you know, that's emblazoned right here. And, you know,
and who's next in the, if you go look at the night sky, who's standing next to the lion?
It's quite literally Indiana Jones, man, where it's like, no, they're going to be off on their measurement because they only have one side of the head. They don't have the opposite side that says remove one kadash for the god whose box this is, you know? So yeah, you've only got partial information because you're only looking at part of the picture. And
exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think this is why, you know, I'm pushing this kind of information is because these images are in front of all of us. I'm not taking like an obscure picture and saying, this is what I think it is. I'm literally showing you the picture without even editing it at all. Just plop it down. I'll put the angles on it. And it's always the same sequence.
And pre-made angles. It's not like you're going into Photoshop and like, let me make this and make it fit. Like, you're just putting in an angle of 23 degrees. Make it red. I showed you before the show how I do it. Well, and it's literally, you are not massaging the image. You aren't zooming the image to make it to that angle. You aren't angling the image or anything like that. It is literally as the image lies, as it's made. And it's pretty fascinating. And it's one of those, once you start really tearing this stuff apart the way that you have, man, I honestly would love to see you carry this forward into Greek work.
Yeah.
With the gods and the goddesses and see how it translates through time.
It across goes oceans. All the way into Da Vinci's time.
Wow.
Da Vinci, and that's what I wrote in The Gates of Anunnaki. I have a whole chapter on Da Vinci's artwork.
Yeah.
And Da Vinci knew about all of these things. He knew all these angles. He knew all these secrets, and he put it right in there. And you know what's really amazing is I'm looking at this work, The Gates of the Anunnaki, which was written last year. Or almost a year ago.
And you're already updating it. Like, we met right as you released this.
I need to go back into that book and redo those pictures because, you know, with the new article that I wrote, there's so much more details that I figured out that make it so much better.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I do have to go back in and edit these books, but I'm happy to do it because – man, do I have the goods right now?
Well, it's phenomenal, man. Especially once you start getting into some of these things like the bulb of Dendera and stuff like that have been mystifying researchers for years and have kerfuffles all over the internet and throughout Ancient Aliens and things like that. And even the image that I have on screen right now, you know, these are some of the things that people have wondered if they're depictions of high technology and that kind of stuff. And it's like, they don't necessarily have to be a depiction of high technology when they are a depiction of higher order thinking.
Well, here, I'll give a gift to your audience.
Oh, please. Because your Dendera work is epic.
Okay, so this is a trace of the Dendera light bulb. And
so awesome.
Just the angle. I know it's a little complicated, but all I can say is, you know, the eye of the serpent is the sun. So from the base of the lotus right into the eye is 23.5 degrees. The bottom of the serpent is set at 18.5 degrees, which is the lunar or the minor lunar declination. All right. You know, 15 degrees from the belly button. That's measuring of time. From the top of the bulb is 28.5 degrees, which is the major lunar declination. So it's actually showing you the different geometries that is the cycles of creation. So you have the snake on the left here, which symbolizes the sun in the minor lunar. And then here on this side, you have the sun. See, 23.5 degrees is how the serpent is going up this tube. But the eye, see the eye here is 23.5 degrees.
Yeah.
The eye here is 28.5 degrees. So this is showing the lunar. So this is the lunar, the major lunar declination, or the major lunar standstill at 28.5 degrees goes into the eye. The serpent is the sun. And the bottom of this tube is 18.5 degrees. And all these lines actually create the entire image going into the belly buttons and the eye. Mm-hmm. So all these angles.
The navel, the point of creation.
The navel, the eyes. That's where all these points come from. So if you just measure the eyes and the belly button, you get all of these angles of solar and lunar cycles, which is the cycle of creation. And that's what we're seeing here is the cycle of creation.
Yeah. And once again, especially somewhere like Egypt, where you are talking about the literal rise or sink of your society via the river, to understand that the moon influences the water, to understand that the lunar cycle is one of the most important things you can be in touch with because of the rise and fall of the Nile with it, even the directional flow of the Nile with it, you know, these were people that mastered the Nile to an extent that they actively floated all their bricks down it. Nothing was locally quarried for these temples. They knew the river so well that they quarried everything upstream and brought it down, you know? And as much research is proving now, like our good friend Stephen Myers says regularly, may have even flooded the Nile and the plain in order to get the bricks where they needed to go, you know? That kind of mastery of water. They built water locks and dams and that kind of stuff. So they had an intimate knowledge of not only the river, but what influenced the river and what made that happen. So that schema that you just showed from the Dendera bulb, updated from the simplified version here on screen, is massively important and probably one of the first things that any incoming priest would have been taught, you know, because without the knowledge in that, we're all going down.
Yes. So as you can see, there has been an evolution in these discoveries or rediscoveries. Mm-hmm. And so I am going to update all of this with the new, because I didn't even think of the moon. When I was doing this, I was all about the sun. It was like, this is all solar.
Yeah.
And now it's like, now that I have the lunar angles, it's like, those are the rest.
Yeah.
That is the rest.
Well, it's the other half of the equation. And once again, yeah. especially, man, as you mentioned beautifully in that paper that's about to be released, that idea of the equinox being represented in the pyramid, that idea of the balance of the yin yang of the sun and moon, the idea of both of these are ruling our life in the middle of the desert. You know, and by these two things, we live or die.
Basically, yeah.
You know, that's a beautiful transmission of knowledge over the ages. Once again, within rock, within something that they knew would last for the ages.
So, you know, I've written the books, but I really believe that this information is too important to just, you know, have in a book away. So. What I'm going to do is once this is released publicly, I'm going to put the PDF on my website.
Yes.
I'm going to link it to anybody that wants it, you know, will have it, put it on all the social medias, just so that we can get this information to the right people.
Well, it's one I'm so entirely glad to hear you say that, because once again, as we state regularly on this show, I've founded Curious Research off the idea that research does not happen in a vacuum, Jason. Researchers need to be connected, you know. Researchers need to know how to present their material to an investor. Like, that's something that one of my favorite people in the world, Alan Alda, like, that is his dying effort, is to take his years of work with Nova, with PVS, and hosting things like that, And I've worked with him at corporate events with scientists and things like that, where he's literally on stage talking to scientists like, you need to learn how to present this in 5 minutes to somebody with $10 million.
Yes.
You know, because that's how research gets done. And if you it's beautiful that you can talk all these things, but if you can't break it down to the common man and to somebody with a wallet and a checkbook, where's the research going to go? You know, and if we can't break these things down, A, to the next generation, pass it along and break it down and reopen that textbook that was written for us by the ancients like you are, Jason, you're literally rewriting that textbook that they wrote so many years ago, and it's beautiful. But also the fact of being able to explain it to people in a common sense way. Without getting bogged down into the religious esoteria of it, you know, in this way that once again, it didn't have to be some crazy high technology or anything like that. It was probably a means by which they passed everyday knowledge along to the people who passed it along, you know, because you don't teach that story to everybody. You teach it to the storyteller is who you teach it to. You know, and the question is, the day you stop having a song singer in the tribe is the day that the tribe starts dying. You know,
exactly. And, you know, so it makes me feel really good that I could bring this out here, because it's not a, you know, in this circle, you know, we talk about theories or what ifs. You know, they can do this, and we apply a lot of ancient knowledge to what we believe today, which is a completely, you know, I guess it's a good approach when you get into it.
Sure.
But you got to shed that all.
You do.
To really get into why this is the way it is. And I've been looking at these things for years, and there are many stages of Jason Quitt. You know, I believed certain things in parts of my life, and I had to shed those things and move to kind of integrate new information and to understand certain things. And, you know, that's why I'm writing these books, because once you see it and understand how it works as a calendar system, the gods and goddesses are like markers in time, you know, which is actually an amazing way of keeping the knowledge going forward, is that when this god appears in the sky, just like a constellation, mm-hmm. when Osiris appears in the sky, which is Orion, this is what happens on Earth. This is what we celebrate. This is the knowledge we teach.
Yeah.
You know, and, there's other researchers, I think, you know, like Micah Dank.
Yep. Yep.
And, you know, we have this kind of same idea, which is not our idea at all. It's that think about the solar mythos. You have the sun moving through the 12 constellations, which is the cycle of the year. And if you look at the sun as a solar deity, you can call it Horus, you know, or Jesus, or whatever you want to give that name to a solar deity. As they go through the 12 constellations, their characteristics and personality changes. So you can have 12 gods or 12 disciples or 12 whatever, or it's just 12 books, 12 tribes, 12 things of information that when the sun enters this constellation, this is the knowledge that's being taught at this time.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And it once again, absolutely amazing the work that you are doing. And I haven't had Micah Dank on in a long time. We chat back and forth in posts on social media regularly. He's a great guy. I haven't had him on in a while. I need to have him back on to talk about his work into that. Because it is fascinating once you get into it, once you start breaking apart these theologies across time, the fact that much of this esoteria is buried within is pretty interesting. I'm a Roman Catholic seminarian in a past life, probably about 20 something years ago, past life now, 1993. But still, you know, it's something that I tell people all the time, like, no, we co-opted a lot of that knowledge. We co-opted a lot, you know, even the idea that Jesus is much more likely a Virgo like me, than actively born in December once you start tracing that star back in the sky as to when it rose, you know? So the whole reason that it lies here is because of Mithra and other knowledge that's passed along because of that, you know? So it's fascinating and interesting, and I love what you are doing to break this out and bring it forward.
This is, sorry, it was just, okay. This is like, once you understand the story of the stars, which is the oldest story there is, and there's many reincarnations of the story. And once you start to learn all these different stories and then pick up the Bible and read it, it's incredible. So, you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, you're discrediting the Bible. I'm like, actually,
no,
this is a continuation of a knowledge that is so powerful.
That's right.
That it's just another incarnation of something that is vitally important to us.
Yeah. Yeah. And even whenever you look at that moving down the Mosaic Abrahamic line and everything else, Jason, like even it ain't discounting the Bible. It's actively supporting it and proving it.
Yes.
The idea that Moses was a son of Pharaoh, he would have been taught all of these things. He would have been taught every one of these things.
That's right.
You know? So you think he didn't take that into his own mystic tradition once he left during the diaspora and everything else? You know, you think that wasn't passed along to Abraham after and all that kind of stuff? Or not Abraham, but to those after?
But you just said
to Aaron
it.
It's and this... the high priests of Israel afterward, you know? That was a whole, one of the whole reasons that the golden bull was shattered to begin with. They were trying to return. Moses had gone. They didn't know what they were doing. Best thing to do is go right back to the gods we know, man. Let's make a golden calf. Let's make us an Apis bull. You know, like that's the first thing they did was resort back to Egyptian tradition.
Exactly.
So, yeah. It's one of those like you said, this doesn't discount the Bible. It fully takes it into account and really breaks a lot of that open.
It shows you the chain or the custody of knowledge.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
And,
beautifully.
And it says it directly in the Old Testament that these people came from out of Egypt.
Yep.
And they brought this new information with a new God. And it's this mystical tradition that's encoded within these works. And like I said, they're just new incarnations of this very ancient understanding that my whole goal is to peel away the mystical and understand the process in which was used to frame this story.
Absolutely. Because once you understand the framing, you can understand the narrative. Yeah. And make no mistake, it is a narrative. I tell people that all the time whenever it comes to the Bible, like I'm pretty well versed in church history. And I'm pretty sure that whole First Council of Nicaea was to set the narrative. Like it was to argue against Arianism, to set up the triumvirate of Trinity, and to set the narrative of who Jesus was and how he prophetically came to be. So that those were the three objectives of the Council of Nicaea, hands down. That's why a whole bunch of other books got taken out, which had a whole bunch of other esoteric knowledge and things like that in it. That's a thing. That's a real actual thing that happened, folks. So, Jason, I cannot thank you enough, as always, for coming on and just breaking this down to such simple means, man. It's beautiful. Your work is amazing. And I truly think I know, number one, the thing that I love is that you have work that came out a year ago that you're updating. That's science. That's science. Because the day it stops being updated, now it's doctrine, my man.
Yeah.
You know, so the fact that you're already updating the work that you've already put out with new information and with information that brings the other side of the spectrum, the lunar side of the spectrum, the lunar side of worship, things like that and how it relates to it, is fantastic. It's fantastic. I see nothing but amazing things for this. And once again, I think what you're about to release is going to be ground shaking in the world of archaeology and especially astroarchaeology. Phenomenal
Thank
work,
you.
Man. Phenomenal
Thank
work.
You.
Let everybody know where they can go to keep up with you, where they can go to subscribe to blogs, where they can go to find everything that is Crystal Sun and more, Jason.
Sure. I'm mostly on Twitter at Jason_Quitt, Quitt. And recently back on Facebook and Instagram after they dropped me. and you can find me on Amazon as well. You just look up Jason Quitt. And I have three books out, which are called, the first one was The Egyptian Postures of Power. And then the second one, which gets into this research, which is Astral Genesis. And then the newest work, which is Gates of the Anunnaki. And I will be updating all of them hopefully very soon because new information has come to light that crystallizes this into a system. So I can't wait for all of that. And thank you. I got lots of crystals too.
Oh, yeah.
That's why it's called the Crystal Sun. I sell crystals.
If you are a crystal fanatic like me, good God, make sure to go look at his Aura Light, man. His stuff that he has is absolutely awesome. Jason, once again, as always, thank you so much for the time, my brother. I appreciate it. Hold the line real quick while we close things out for the show. While you are online checking out everything that is Jason Quitt over at thecrystalsun.com, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm, folks. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can find all of the video content that we produce, as well as all the video channels of our guests embedded right there for easy liking and following and watching, all that kind of stuff. You can also get your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log. If you are a field researcher in the world of paranormal, cryptozoology, UFO, UAP, this is the book for you. It is made specifically as a field data log for your observations so that you get all of the data down as it happens in real time, not hours after the investigation, not tomorrow after you get home, right there so that your data is ready to shake hands with science come the day that it needs to. As well as the conversation, everybody. And remember, thank you for tuning in. Thank you for always tuning in with your open hearts, your open minds, because that is what makes the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media and Aftermath Media family of podcasts. For more great shows and members-only content, visit aftermath.media today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.